The Sunstone Foundation presents The Healing Imagination, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Can we begin? The Rocky Mountain Water, for donating their water to us, is outside in the hallways, and we are really appreciative of that. And the other announcement is that we need any banquet tickets that, if you're not going to use them, if you want to return them to us, that'd be great. We'd love it as a donation. And if not a donation, we would just love to be able to give you some money back. So if you have any, take them to the registration table. About 4 years ago, my book group got together. That's when we began. And one of the first books that Margaret Toscano brought to us was The Feminine and Jungian Psychology and Christian Theology. And it was so amazing to us that there is so much in that book. It gave us insights that we had never had before, and we wanted more. We wanted to read more. And we discovered that there was a lot more. And the more we read, the more we wanted to have the Ulanovs come and speak with us, and so we began calling them. And they started out by saying, "We just don't speak in August. I'm sorry." Of course, that didn't stop us. So we just continued to call year after year. And I think it was the begging this year that did it. But they're here, and I am so pleased. And so first let me tell you about Barry Ulanov is going to speak first. He is a Macintosh professor of English emeritus. And Ann Ulanov is a professor of psychiatry and religion at Union Theological Seminary and has a private practice and is a psychoanalyst. They have written many, many books separately, but some of the books they have written together are Cinderella and Her Sisters, which is a book about envy and envying, Religion and the Unconscious, Primary Speech, a book about prayer, and each book just opened up worlds to me personally. And so now I'd like to welcome Ann and Barry Ulanov.
Thank you, Lynn. We promise, at least on this day in August, to be audible. First, I will talk, then Ann, and then you'll have to listen to me again. And then Ann will come back at the end. We alternate and work together as we do so much in so much of what we do as speakers and writers, as persons. Our point today is in one sense very simple. We want to stress the reality of the imagination. One of the very sad facts about the decline in exposure to the imagination, in understanding of the imagination, is that the word has come on in most people's lives in a setting of the imaginary as against the true, the real, the factual. That's a fundamental mistake and a grievous loss. It leaves those who are so persuaded, ill-equipped to deal with reality, a large part of themselves having been surrendered in such a way that they are not up to observing accurately either the outside world or, even more important, the inside world, their inside world. They have lost a sense of the world as a forest of symbols, of those things for which only the imagination is organized to make sense, to make choice, to enlarge us as we look through the forest to the individual symbols, and then come to cull them and call them back into our individual and community lives. Community, unity. We are wholes with a W, not with an H. There is something in us that demands wholeness. and much in our world that forbids it. What we're talking about today, trying to make as commendable as we're capable of doing, is that primordial storehouse, those great contents for which the imagination is so generously equipped to make observation, make sense, make purposeful. Stores of images and signs with corresponding meanings and lines to truths, elusive truths, absolutely elusive, but no less true for being mysterious, darting, and hard to get at. There are coils of feeling here which we neglect at our peril. For what we are neglecting is not only the richness of our own lives now in this world, but that large healing reach across centuries, across eons, which is the true history of humanity. André Malraux, that extraordinary sometime novelist, museum keeper, at least the Museum Without Walls, important figure in the de Gaulle governments, in his most interesting survey of the impact of the visual arts on the modern sensibility, said that history is not a succession of ideologies or philosophies, but a gallery of images. And it is that gallery that we speak for today. Speak for because it is a reality, a central reality. Speak for because without it, we do not speak sense. We do not make sense. Life is a gathering into the imagination, a gathering of metaphors and allegories, a gathering of thoughts and feelings, of spiritual experience and sexual experience, or dodgings from either, in which nothing is simply and straightforwardly denotative, in which almost everything suggests, more or less points to, indicates, but does not come down upon in simple, easy dictionary definition. If it did, it would require no imagination. It would be like adding numbers in the most elementary sort of arithmetic. It is what Coleridge, the man more than any other responsible for giving imagination its wide currency since the early 19th century, is what Coleridge called a union of deep feeling with profound thought. He was terribly moved, and terribly in all the senses of that adverb, in awe, in fright to some extent, by what he found in his first experiences of his good friend, the poet Wordsworth, the fine balance, as he described it, of truth and observing with the imaginative faculty in modifying the objects observed. And above all, the original gift of spreading the tone, the atmosphere, and with it, the depth and height of the ideal world. But understand, when he talks about the ideal world, he doesn't mean something remote from us. He means something well within each of us, the least of us, the best of us, all of us. He makes a distinction between the primary imagination and the secondary imagination. And I explain this not in my role as a professor of the languages and the literatures, but as a human being feeling these things earnestly and hoping that some of that earnestness may be contagious. For him, the primary imagination is something that he describes in terms very close to what modern depth psychology calls the unconscious, but it has a religious dimension. It is the living power, he calls it, the prime agent of all human perception, and a repetition in the finite mind, our minds, of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. What an audacious idea. That each of us, au fond, at bottom, responds to the world around us as to the creation, as to the first day of being on earth, in the universe, anywhere. We are that in our earnest, central, rich selves. The secondary imagination is an echo. It coexists with the conscious will, as he puts it. But in its kind of agency, it's identical with the primary. It's what makes an artist. It dissolves, it diffuses, it dissipates in order to recreate. Now, not all of us have the gifts he's talking about here. But all of us can diffuse. All of us can dissipate in the positive sense, dissolve. Take what we see and make great sense of us, of where we are ourselves, where we can be said to be. But there's a major problem. Indifference. Not simply that lack of exposure which goes with the sorry thing that education has become so much of the time, but the indifference product of, or cause perhaps, of the failure to make the adequate claim we must make upon ourselves. The claim of our egos. The claim ultimately of ourselves, if we move along, to use these Jungian terms, in the enrichment that enlarges ego, our simple names, our most elementary identities, into selves. The claims of life itself. The willingness to go beyond surfaces, the insistence upon finding the depths, the insistence to the point of a Coleridge-like audacity on signs, real signs, our signs, signs that become symbols, symbols that become being, symbols that lead us to the great infinite I am. The Polish poet Czesław Miłosz, who in 1980 was awarded the Nobel Prize, whom we've had in this country for many years out in California as a teacher, has a lovely poem written in 1961 based upon an old hymn, a Latin hymn, Veni Creator, Come Holy Ghost is the way it's often translated, writes this simple poem that says it all. I'm only a man. I need visible signs. I tire easily building the stairway of abstraction. Many a time I ask, you know it well, that the statue in church lift its hands only once, just once, for me. But I understand that signs must be human. Therefore, call one man anywhere on earth. Not me, after all, I have some decency. And allow me, when I look at him, to marvel at you. That's what the imagination is about. The first person singular becomes the first person plural. We look at one and another and another and another, men, women, children, and we see reflected in them as in every aspect of the world around us, all that is created, nature itself, the least, the best, the worst. And we see something of that primary truth. We may not have the words for it. We may not yet recognize or identify the healing strengths. But we can, if we open ourselves, find the paradoxical truths. An observation observed but not articulated. A feeling felt but not verbalized or even clearly translated into temperature, image, touch, whatever. These things dwelling in us, expectant us, welcoming us, do in fact expect us, do in fact welcome us, greet us. But we must move first. They will stay remote forever unless we reach out to them. Reach out to them, it might be said, in the prayerful movement of the senses. The first step on the way to the healing imagination.
Barry's talked about the reality of the imagination and the necessity to recognize it as real images. Without doing that, we lose both reality and the imagination. I want to direct our attention specifically to imagination in the religious realm. And pictures we have of God, images we have of God, always precede and underlay any words we achieve for God. Images are alive. They're the real thing. Our words come and they go. And images in relation to God might fall into two categories for the sake of simplicity. What our own private pictures are for God that come upon us sometimes unbidden, startling us, and sometimes come to us many years after we have waited and longed for their arrival. Now, perhaps as I give you some examples, you'll be thinking of your own pictures of God and when they have arrived, for these are moments that mark our lives. We never forget them, even though we do not often understand them. And these pictures come in the language of depth psychology, which echoes the language of Coleridge that Barry was telling us about, through primary process, the unconscious, and through consciousness. Here are some examples. A man dreamt that he found himself worshiping a forbidding half-human, half-animal figure seated in a regal chair, robed and commanding and really quite terrifying. The figure stretched out its left hand, which was cleft, and as the cleft opened toward the dreamer, a great hissing came out. The man woke up, terrified. Or another dreamer, a woman, dreamt that a woman who was authoritative to her put the question to her, "Where does the spirit come into you?" And the dream woman said to the dreamer, "For me, it comes in through the back." Now, this was a dream the dreamer had, three and a half years before she slipped on the ice and broke her back. She cracked the three vertebrae right at the middle of her spine, joining the top and the bottom. And through that life experience, that convalescing experience, her whole life changed. And it was as if a new vision of what life was all about came into her. And only when she was lying on her back did she remember that dream of some time ago. Or still another example, again of a woman through the unconscious, through a dream, simply a dream statement, which read or sounded, "You do not get a backlog of love. You must always spend it. Hence you are always poor, and hence you will always see God." Now these kinds of dreams, they're very startling. They're not like our usual dreams about laundry, menus, somebody we saw that day. For the dreamer, they are, we might even say, numinous. Though we don't understand them, we feel something has happened to us. But such events that we would think of as numinous may also come to us in our conscious life. They may come to us through groups that we belong to, groups whose conscious and unconscious life eventually yield images or symbols that represent a high or highest value. I'm thinking now of symbols that have made their way into theology, black theology, with the symbol of blackness, where it is felt that God must be near enough to us to know our experience of color. Or some of the female images of God come out of groups of women who live and work and talk and suffer together and images collect underneath the surface and eventually come forward as expressing a God image to the members of that group. Then, on the other hand, we have all the images our religious tradition gives us. And these are many and various, even within one tradition. For example, God, as the psalmist says, as having wings under which we crawl, or God as refuge, God as in the Holy of Holies on that mysterious mercy seat that hovers above the ark in the Holy of Holies, or God as one who hates and sends us into battle, or God as one who loves and calls a people to be his bride. From our tradition of saints, some of these traditional images are called out. A frequent image is that of journey of the soul to the center, journey of the people to the promised land. Saint Teresa of Avila's wonderful image of the interior castle. We go round and round to the various rooms, and after a long time we come to the very center, and at the center of us dwells the Almighty, the Holy. Now, any of us who are religious or belong to religious groups have a specific burden and a specific privilege, because our personal images that come to us either through our groups or through our unconscious dreams, they're on one side, and a gap exists between them and our images that we take from our tradition. And in addition, all of these human images, personal, social, or traditional, from our scriptures, from our received revelations that we write about, that we pray with, that we worship with, there is a gap between all of those and who God really is. And the burden and the privilege of the religious person and the religious community is to use the imagination to weave connecting links back and forth over those gaps. Spiritual life is always a very messy, untidy, unfinished, even unraveled business. The edges of the gaps never touch and fit. They're always sort of like that, or like this. And very often the dangers, both psychologically and in terms of one's faith, is that we fall into the gap instead of being able to use the imagination, instead of being able to refuse that indifference that Barry was talking about. But to use the imagination to weave back and forth between our private images and our traditional images, between our social images and our personal images, between all of our human images and the mystery of the divine. Having said all this, then one has to say, well, why don't we do this? Why not? Because it's absolutely terrifying. We tend to deny the images. That's one danger. Keep them over there. Let's talk about them. Let's not talk from them or to them. This is very dangerous because we get a religion of words. We get a religion that is no longer anchored in that primary imagination, in Coleridge's words, or in primary process, the language of the unconscious, in depth psychology's words. We get a religion of talk about, talk to, talk at. In technical terms, it's sort of a schizoid religion. It flees away from the living moment. And if one looks at any holy scriptures, one finds, for example, Jesus always talking in both languages, of primary and secondary, unconscious and conscious, imagination and rational. Jesus talks of God as Father welcoming his Son, of God as woman looking for the lost mite, as God as dinner party host, as wedding guest, inviting the wedding guests. Jesus speaks in words that do not obfuscate or cover up or run away from the living word. And much of our trouble in religion comes when we replace words with words, the living word. Our theologies, even our liturgies, can become quite dry. We go through them. We may even know them by rote, but they don't quicken the soul. They don't ignite the heart. And our sanctuaries are no longer places of fire, a cave, a refuge, a source of solace. Instead, they are filled with words, chatter. Now, the other danger is not that we run away from the images, but that we identify with them. We become them. We lose the imagination because we identify with the images and take them as reality. The most serious example of this way of falling in the gap are all the poor souls suffering in mental institutions, to whom often numinous images appear. They come up and they go down, and they come up again and they go down. There's no interceding ego. There's no interceding community to catch those images like fish and learn how to eat them. Instead, they come up and they go down, and the person's life is lost. In less grave examples, when we identify with our images, and these are powerful things, they don't just go away if we put them out of our minds. They go down into our unconscious, and they pull us after them. And in less serious terms, what happens is that then we think we have the truth. We are full of the numinous image. It has us. It no longer inhabits us. We no longer make a space for it, even a tabernacle for it. We are it. And then we want to coerce our neighbor into also identifying with it. So that our version, our vision of God, the truth, the proper liturgy, the way to preach a sermon, this is it. If you don't do it, off with your head. It's dangerous. It's the source of theological sadism and bullying. We find we may insist on literal texts or literal translations of texts into specific political agendas, or specific reduction of text to psychological forces. We need our images, but we need not become them. We need to identify them to ourselves, to be conscious of them. These are the sources of our enthusiasms for being, and what gives us courage to go on when we can't go on anymore. We need them. We need to know what they are, and that they are real as images. Real images.
Anne has described these two dangers, threats, what I called indifference, what becomes sometime retreat as she described it, or identification with the image. How do we emerge from that? So poorly tutored as we are, so little expected of us, even by us ourselves. The answer is something audacious, large in scale and yet adaptable to our smallness of being. It is what is called contemplation. One need not be a card-carrying mystic to contemplate. It's everybody's resource. Let me give you an example. Gregory the Great, almost a millennium and a half ago, 1,400 years ago, Gregory the Great, a pope, the one connected forever with Gregorian chant, though he did not himself develop it but simply supported it, fundamental in the development of Christian liturgy, a man essentially of an Augustinian breadth of vision, wrote a series of commentaries on the book of Job. They became long celebrated, known as the Magna Moralia, the great moralization of the book of Job. They became, in effect, a sort of guide to reading signs and symbols. Sounds scholarly, abstruse, remote, none of those things. Like contemplation, Gregory in this work talked in terms ordinary people can understand if they don't become too much awed by the difficult associations, not his, others. In the course of the Magna Moralia, he asks this lovely series of rhetorical questions and answers them. Who may see to the bottom of the marvelous works of Almighty God? How he made all things of nothing? How the very framework of the world is arranged with a marvelous mightiness of power? And the heaven hung above the atmosphere, and the earth balanced above the abyss? How this whole universe consists of things visible and invisible? How he created man, so to say, gathering together in a small compass another world, yet a world of reason? How constituting this world of soul and flesh, he mixed the breath and the clay by an unsearchable disposal of his might? Apart then of these things we know, and apart we even are, yet we omit to admire them, because those things which are full of marvels for an investigation deeper than we can reach have become cheap from custom in the eyes of the human. If a dead man is raised to life, all men spring up in astonishment. Yet every day one that had no being is born, and no man wonders, though it is plain to see that without doubt it is a greater thing for that to be created which was without being than for that which had being to be restored. Aaron's dry rod budded. Every day a tree is produced from the dry earth, and no man wonders. 5,000 men were filled with 5 loaves. Every day grains of seed that are sown and multiplied in the fullness of years come to us, and no man wonders. Full of wonder, he says, are all the things which human beings never think to wonder at, because they are by habit become dull to the consideration of them. The imagination is our contemplative tool. It is our way to go in that magnificent Latin motto of St. Paul's in his letter to the Romans, per visibilia ad invisibilia, through those things which we see which are visible to those which we cannot. The imagination is a massive, majestic, and yet very ordinary resource. It is the making visible of the sacred, giving shape, dimension, form to the holy. For as Pascal said, nature is an image of grace. We may love flowers, but how often do we go out and see them? Trees, the flowers and trees which are our fellow human beings. How often do we greet each other and the world in which we greet each other and say, grace, grace, grace is among us. Always among us, in pain and pleasure, in terrible suffering, even in the mediocrities of ordinary lives, in the boredoms to which so much of the time so many of us are called. How often do we turn round in the great forest of the human, in the great garden of the human, and look at the vast range of colors, the astonishing multiplicity of textures, and wonder, and look contemplatively, with or without words, with or without a richness of images, but simply say to ourselves, or feel to ourselves, what an awesome sight, what an astonishing thing to be here, one of these astonishing things called people. The haunting terror of the modern age, and especially of the second half of this century, is subject matter. We are frightened by it because we are doubting so much of the time. Doubt ourselves. Doubt what we have done. Doubt what we have left undone. There's good reason to be haunted, and there's good reason to be the doubting creatures we've become, but not to be so doubting, not to be so fearful in the face of the resources that we provide simply by getting up in the day and going out into it and being human in our differences. For what we have in common is our differences. That is the contemplative strength beyond all others, to celebrate as we see and hear and taste and touch, even smell what we are in our differences, even when the smells overcome us. Each smell is an individual smell, and all the smells together make sometimes, not a pretty thing, a collective stench. Can we celebrate that contemplatively? Yes. Because it is the hallmark, even the stink, of being, living being, pressing itself upon us, saying each one with his or her smell, look, taste, touch, sound, I am who I am, echoing the maker of each one of us. In saying that, finding the all-embracing unity of mankind in its diversity. Rilke, the greatest of the modern German poets, addresses God in these terms and speaks in a sense of us in doing so. He says, Du Nachbar Gott, you neighbor God. God comes to us this way in the neighbor. Jesus told us this again and again. Jesus came to us as a neighbor. But it isn't enough to think in the abstract term, love thy neighbor as thyself. Love him, her, it. Love her, it, with its distinctive, with her distinctive, with his distinctive odor. Shape. Way of moving, awkwardness as well as grace. For there is as much grace in the awkwardness as in the elegant gesture, the splendid movement, the choreographed kind of movement. Augustine said, if I saw myself, I would see thee, speaking to God, in such neighborly terms. I'm saying to you, if we saw each of those around us, we would see God. That is the ultimate message. We prove our existence this way. We approve of our existence this way. It is a contemplative ascent. But it must be total. This is the only totalitarianism that makes sense. We must say the wholeness of being is good because it is whole. We cannot say of any group of people, they're out. We cannot say of any group of people, only these are in. We cannot, in our struggles to make a better but necessarily imperfect world, we cannot say we must conform to this struggle. We must follow that rhythm. Nothing else will make for perfection. That won't work. It will make for a greater imperfection. We are moving slowly, irresistibly, I think, but still quite slowly, from the ruins of our desertion of our appropriate claims to our egos, to ourselves, to life. It's a long and difficult process, but it's a magnificent one. Slow it may be, let us not be slothful in following it. Let us allow ourselves to be shaken to the inmost depths of our being by the imagination that will show us that we have depths to our being. Let us be willing to find the moral illumination that comes as we move through two major sets of resources, the arts and religion, from a static life to a dynamic life. I follow here a distinction made by that great philosopher who won of all things the Nobel Prize for Literature, because he was of all things a philosopher who wrote beautifully, Henri Bergson, the Frenchman. Some few years before he died shortly after the beginning of the Second World War, he wrote a book called The Two Sources of Morality and Religion. The movement of the book, and it is a choreographed movement, it dances, it has the graces of a beautiful body that exhibits some animating spirit. He moves in this book from the static to the dynamic, as he moved in his life from the static to the dynamic. From an honorably discharged profession as a philosopher to a deep and moving witness to his faith. His point, very simple. The mystics, he says, unanimously bear witness that God needs us, just as we need God. Why should he need us? Unless it be to love us. Now, this is something you cannot persuade yourself about. I cannot persuade you about by sheer logic. But a contemplative turning of the resources of the imagination in the direction that Bergson moves in this book, that we all should move in our lives, will show you the solidity, will show all of us the richness, the grace of that understanding. Creation then appears in Bergson's extraordinary image as God undertaking to create creators that he may have besides himself beings worthy of his love. Now, can we get up in the morning and say, I would like to be a being worthy of his love? That may be a mouthful before you've brushed your teeth. But it's a good thing to ask oneself, or even more simply, ask, as Bernard of Clairvaux, that 12th century saint, that magnificent man who found God honey on the tongue, his words. Ask yourself, as he did every day in his life after a certain early maturity, why are you here? That's not a rude awakening, it's a lovely one. You may not have a quick answer, but it's a very good question. Bergson concludes, and I will conclude, with a series of other images. The images that we know only too well, any day's paper will support them, any television viewing will support them. The images of the groaning, almost crushed condition of modern man, as he says, crushed by the weight of our own progress. But he says, and I want as strongly as I can to underscore what he says, we have our future in our own hands. We must decide. He says in general, I say each day, every day, whether we want to go on living or not. I don't mean the choices between suicide and moving through the day. No, the choice is between barely moving through the day and being moved all through the day. Ours is the responsibility of deciding if we want just to live or we want to do something more. We want contemplatively, imaginatively to wonder again, to be healed by our wonder, to make that special effort to fulfill even in what Bergson calls this refractory planet. And we can go further because we've sent people so much farther. We can say in this refractory universe, Neptune, someday the edge of the galaxy. We can decide whether we want to fulfill what he calls the essential function of the universe, which is for making in us what the machinery of the universe is designed to do. Gods. Gods. That great God whom we join, not in a new paganism, but in the deepest confirmation of a true Christianity, has made us beings to contemplate alongside the Trinity, alongside our Creator. We have been created to be fellows of creation. All we need is a little imagination.
Can we recapture our wonder, Barry asks. And it comes through seeing through the visible, the invisible. Now, in my concluding remarks, I want to take up what happens when we come to the end of our images, which, after all, are our visible. How do they really point to the invisible? And before that, one very sticky problem. It can be voiced in a question. Is there such a thing as evil imaginings? Can our images ever be wrong, take us down the garden path, be destructive? This is a very tough question. Depth psychology has a very tough answer, which I think is this, that all our images are true if they are ours. That's the wide openness of the psyche. And even images that in psychology we call mad or distorted or perverted, one of the secrets of their power over us is that hiding in a compulsive addiction, lurking in an obsession, is a bit of our true self that we cannot yet put our hands on, that presses us to include it in the whole of our personality. So to say the images are wrong, to cast them out, is to leave that bit of self orphaned, with no place to lay its head, no place to be welcomed in. Now let me give you two examples of very hard images. One is taken from the work of a psychiatrist in Texas, Harry Wilmer, with veterans of the Vietnamese War who are inpatient patients suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Some of these men have not had a full night's sleep in over a decade. They are awakened one, two, three times a night by violent, traumatic images in their nightmares. Surely these would be called evil. Wilmer's way of treating this was to create very small dream circles, very small communities, where the men would take turns and they would tell their nightmare in very specific detail, and others would simply listen, and they would repeat this over months, and the others would listen, respect the evil images, take them into their own consciousness, give them a place in the community of dreamers. For some of these men, gradually the psyche would change the dream, first in the most minute detail, which was the beginning of the psyche appropriating this trauma, digesting it. Perhaps we might even say, in light of what Barry has just said, contemplating it. Or a second example, to do with an individual, if one is caught in a compulsion, caught in a masochistic ritual, or a sadistic one, surely those images feel evil to us. But that doesn't make them go away. And calling them evil doesn't make them go away. It is only by finding a place to receive them, to listen to them, to hear hiding in them the lost orphan bit of self that has no other language but the language of imagination and image to tell its story. Only then can that piece of self be brought back to the rest of the personality. From a theological point of view, we have to ask about these images that often make us feel poisoned and full of poison. Who then is the guest that is trying to come in this disguise? This does not mean that all images are positive. It does not mean that we don't pay in blood, let alone wasted years, if we suffer from compulsions or obsessions. But it does mean we extend a hand of mercy, that we open the community to the cast-off one, the least of the brethren, the least of the sisters, and show mercy and welcome. Now, the larger issue is, if we consciously identify what our private images of God are, what our group images of God are, what our tradition gives us, offers us as images of God, what happens when we come to the end of all these images? And come to the end we will. Perhaps as you look back over your lives, you'll see where some of the images have changed and ones that were pivotal no longer are, and you're only thinking of them now. Anyone who takes a prayer life seriously, sooner or later, is brought to the end of the images that have enabled that prayer in the first place. Anyone who takes a worshiping life seriously, sooner or later, is brought to the end of the images that circulate in that worship. Why? Because we don't get to God from our side. We don't cross the gap by building on our images. It's only God who crosses the gap from the other side to us. God invades. God comes as an event, invading our human will, our imagination, and rearranging all the ways we have seen and pictured God. This isn't an invasion that oppresses, but one that liberates. It's not an invasion that offers us a choice of options, and then we choose one and decide on another direction. It's a power that enters our lives both individually and corporately, that alters the entire force field, not changing a direction, but making a new creation. So we have to identify our images, and then we have to disidentify from them, which doesn't mean we lose them or we ever go beyond the imagination. It's through the visible to the invisible. But we know that our imagination is within our human limits. and that God who addresses us will invade our humanity and offer us something new. Now, it depends on what your connecting link is to God, what way your trauma comes. It might be a theological concept that gives you a glimpse of the holy. And after a certain point in your life, that concept is as dry as dust. It doesn't work anymore. It might be a particular liturgical form of worship. It might be a private symbol. Or it might be something that comes to you at a high point of contemplation and imagination. God creates us as image makers, but it is also God who breaks our image and pulls us out beyond our finite limits to a vision of the holy, so that our whole life is almost like identifying the images, disidentifying, identifying again, disidentifying. In the interest of time, I'll just give one short example that was taken from the meditation and prayer exercise of a woman who was middle-aged, black woman, was very sophisticated in her own psychological development. And she was using a prayerful exercise built somewhat on the Ignatian model of composition of place and time. She imagined that she was the woman who touched Jesus in the crowd to be healed of her hemorrhaging. She envisioned herself in a hot village, dusty. She heard the crowd gathering, and she dragged herself out to touch Jesus, to be healed. But here the imagination contemplation took its own autonomous turn. It stood over against her plans, what she had in mind, what she had imagined. The crowd grew thicker, and she couldn't get through it. And in her imagining, Jesus was now leaving. He was turning. He was 50 feet away from me, she said. And he turned around and he saw me in the dust and he said, "What do you want?" in just that tone of voice. She fumbled, she stammered, she said, I coughed up, I suffer, I'm divided, I'm pulled apart. Jesus